The pleasure is all mine. Thank you so much for that beautiful music and wonderful introduction. It's really an honor to be here. Of course, I wish I were there with you all in person, but I think learning how to do this is part of what it means to be educated in the world we're in right now. And I'm really honored to be here, particularly to speak under the theme of what it means to be educated. And I want to address that on multiple levels. And I want to start with sort of the personal level, the personal development level, getting educated about ourselves and where we fit. And I want to start with what has been probably the most impactful modern story of development. It starts with this guy, Tiger Woods. Father famously bought him a putter when he was 7 months old. At 10 months, he started imitating his father's swing. At 2 years old, you can go and see him on YouTube showing off his swing on national television. By 3, he's saying, I'm going to be the next great golfer. I'm going to be the next Jack Nicklaus. By 3 years old, he's famous as a teenager. And fast forward to age 21, he's the greatest golfer in the world. It's kind of that quintessential 10,000 hours story, or scientists actually call that the deliberate practice framework. Another one that's featured in a number of best-selling books is that of the three Polgar sisters. This is kind of like the real life Queen's Gambit, if you watch that show in certain ways. This is Laszlo Polgar with his three daughters, who he decided he would teach them chess in a very specialized technical manner from a very early age. And really what he wanted to do was to show that with a head start in deliberate practice, any child could become a genius in anything. And in fact, two of his daughters went on to become grandmaster chess players. So when I left my track where I was training to be a scientist in my past life, and became the science writer at Sports Illustrated, I got curious. I said, well, if this incredibly influential work, this 10,000 hours rule, holds in our field, then we should see that athletes who are elite spend more time in that so-called deliberate practice. Now, this is not playing around or experimenting. This is effortful, cognitively engaged, error correction-focused practice. We should see that they spend more time in that kind of practice. And in fact, when scientists study athletes, they see that elites spend more time in deliberate practice. Not a huge surprise. But when they actually track the athletes over the course of their development, the pattern looks like this. The future elites actually spend less time early on in deliberate practice in the sport in which they will become elite. There's a lot of individual variation, but they tend to have what scientists call a sampling period, where they do a variety of activities. That could be other sports, it could be dance, rock climbing, martial arts, whatever. They gain these broad general physical skills that scaffold later technical skills. They learn about their own interests. They learn about their own abilities. And they systematically delay specializing until later than peers who plateau at lower levels. That was not what I had expected to see. That doesn't really comport with this 10,000 hours rule. So then I got curious about other domains that we associate with obligatory early specialization. The next one that came to mind was music. Now, this is research from world-class music academies. And what I want to draw your attention to is this. The musicians deemed exceptional by their instructors didn't start spending more time in that deliberate practice than those deemed average until their third instrument. They too tended to have a sampling period. Even musicians we think of as famously precocious, like Yo-Yo Ma, went through this period where they sampled different instruments, did a lot of self-directed activity before focusing in. But this research is almost totally ignored by the public. Much more influential is the first page of the book, Battle Hymn of the Tiger Mother, in which the author recounts assigning her daughter violin and having her do 5-6 hours of deliberate practice a day. Now, the part that doesn't seem to have stuck in the public consciousness is a part later in the book where her daughter turns to her and says, "You picked it, not me," and quits. Right? We seem to have kind of forgotten about that part. But seeing this pattern, this surprising pattern again in another domain that I thought required early specialization, made me curious about domains that affect even more people, like higher education. An economist found a natural experiment in the higher ed systems of England and Scotland. In the period he studied, the systems were really similar, except in England, students had to pick a specialty in their mid-teen years because they had to apply to a specific course of study for college. Whereas in Scotland, students could, if they wanted to, keep sampling things throughout college if they wanted. And the economist's question was, who tends to win the trade-off, the early or the late specializers? And what he saw was that the early specializers, in fact, jump out to an income lead because they have more domain-specific skills. The late specializers get to try more different things. They learn more about their own interests and abilities. And when they do pick, they have higher match quality, which is a term economists use to describe the degree of fit between one's interests and abilities in the work that they do. And so they have higher match quality when they do pick. So they have higher growth rates. By 6 years out, they flew past the early specializers. Meanwhile, the early specializers started leaving their career tracks in much higher numbers, despite having more disincentive from doing so, essentially because they were made to choose so early that they more often made poor choices. So the late specializers sort of lost in the short term, but won big in the long run. And now seeing this pattern yet again made me wonder about the developmental backgrounds of people whose work I had most admired. And I started kind of digging into those. Like, for example, the musician Duke Ellington, who shunned music lessons as a kid and focused on baseball and painting and drawing and only came back to music later. Or Maryam Mirzakhani, who dreamed of becoming a novelist, instead went on to become the first and so far only woman to win the Fields Medal, which is the most prestigious prize in the world in math. Or Vincent van Gogh, who had 5 different careers, each of which he deemed his true calling at some point, before flaming out spectacularly, and nearing the age of 30 with no accomplishments and no possessions, picked up a book for 10-year-olds called The Guide to the ABCs of Drawing and started drawing what he saw around him. That worked out okay. Claude Shannon was an electrical engineering student at the University of Michigan when he was forced to take a philosophy course to fulfill a requirement. And in the course, he learned about a century-old system of logic by which true and false statements could be coded with ones and zeros and solved like math problems. This had accomplished basically nothing except getting into philosophy courses for about 80 years. Then Shannon did an internship at a phone company and realized he could use the phone relay switches, like those ones and zeros, and code information into circuits. And that gave rise to binary code, upon which all of our digital computers rely today. As Shannon said, it just so happened nobody was familiar with these two different areas at the same time. This is my personal sort of role model, Frances Hesselbein. This is me with her. She took her first professional job at the age of 54 after a long life of volunteering. And then she soon went on to become the CEO of the Girl Scouts, which was in crisis. It's hemorrhaging members and volunteers. Society had changed in the late 60s and early 70s for girls and women, and Girl Scouts had not. Frances came in, turned the organization around, tripled minority membership, added 130,000 volunteers. These were people she paid in a sense of mission, not in money, turned the cookie business into $250 million a year, and changed the organization from one that was preparing girls for life in the home to one that was preparing them for jobs in math and science. This is one of the badges that came out of her tenure. It's binary code for girls learning about computers. Frances, after Girl Scouts, she now today works still 5 days a week in Manhattan at a leadership institute that she runs, and she's only 105, so who knows what she'll get up to next. And finally, my own friend and favorite writer, Sebastian Younger. This is Sebastian harnessed in the upper canopy of a pine tree. He was working as an arborist, trimming the tops of trees in his late 20s, when he accidentally cut through the back of his leg with a chainsaw. He's very proud of having seen his own Achilles tendon. That's like a very Sebastian kind of thing. And it gave him this idea to write about dangerous but underappreciated jobs. And 2 months later, he's still limping around when a fishing vessel goes missing off the coast of the city where he was living. And he decides he's going to write about commercial fishing as a dangerous but underappreciated job. And that becomes the book, The Perfect Storm. So if you've heard the phrase, a perfect storm, that's because Sebastian almost lopped his foot off with a chainsaw. And it gave him an idea to take something bad and turn it into something useful. All of these people who had these incredibly winding paths where they didn't see what was coming. Right, but we never hear these developmental stories. I didn't hear them, even though I followed all these people's work until I really dug into it. We don't really hear about, say, LinkedIn's recent research on 500,000 members that found that the strongest predictor of who would go on to become an executive was the number of different job functions someone had worked across. But we don't usually tell someone, go work across a lot of job functions, right? We only hear sort of the Tiger Woods stories, or like Mark Zuckerberg story, right? Famously dropped out of college, and he famously said, young people are just smarter. He was 22 when he said that. No offense at all, students, but you don't hear him saying that anymore, really. And in fact, he's the exception. Recent research from Northwestern, MIT, and the Census Bureau found that the average age of a founder of a fast-growing tech startup on the day of founding is 45. But we don't hear those stories. We just hear the Zuckerberg story. Even when the work is really famous, we don't hear those stories. For example, here's someone whose work I've followed for a long time. Here he's at age 6 wearing a Scottish rugby kit. His mother was a tennis coach but declined to coach him. So he tried tennis, wrestling, skiing. He wouldn't return balls normally, not so much into deliberate practice, so she wouldn't coach him. He tried some table tennis, basketball, swimming. When his coaches wanted to move him up to play with older boys, he actually declined because he just wanted to talk about pro wrestling with his friends after practice. And he kept trying different sports, rugby, soccer, basketball, skiing, badminton, skateboarding, handball. Unlike Tiger, he was not focused on being the next great from an early age. In fact, when he became good enough to warrant an interview with his local newspaper, the reporter asked him what he would purchase with his first hypothetical paycheck if he ever became a professional. And the boy said a Mercedes. And his mother was appalled by this. And she asked the reporter if she could listen to the interview recording. And the reporter obliged. And it turned out the boy had said Mercedes in Swiss German. He just wanted more CDs, not a Mercedes. And his mother was okay with that. So maybe with this hint, you can guess who this is. This is Roger Federer. Turned out okay. Every bit as famous as an adult as Tiger Woods. And yet, even tennis enthusiasts usually don't know anything about his developmental story, even though it's the norm, according to the science, not the exception. Why is that? Well, I think it's partly because the Tiger story is so dramatic. Like my running buddy Malcolm Gladwell says, when you go on YouTube and see a two-year-old on national television, it's like a human cat video. You know, you have to share it and you can't look away. But I think there's more to it than that. I think it's also that it feels like this tidy narrative that we can apply to anything that we want to be good at in our own lives. And I respect that, but I think it's a big mistake because it turns out that golf in many ways is kind of a uniquely horrible model of almost everything else that humans want to learn. Golf is the epitome of what the psychologist Robin Hogarth called a kind learning environment. A kind learning environment is one in which next steps and goals are given to you, rules are clear and never change, patterns repeat, feedback is quick and accurate. Work next year will look like work last year. Unfortunately for our ability to extrapolate from the Polgar experiment, or from Queen's Gambit, if you will, chess is also a pretty kind learning environment. It's actually the grandmaster's advantage is largely based on knowledge of recurring patterns. So that if you haven't started studying those patterns, by age 12, the chance of reaching international master status drops from about 1 in 4 to about 1 in 55. But that's also why it's relatively so easy to automate. So if you're in an area that's really amenable to this hyper early specialization, you may not want to be there much longer because those are the easiest areas to automate. Now, on the other end of the spectrum are what Hogarth called wicked learning environments. Now, wicked learning environments, what he meant with that terminology was domains where the next steps and goals may not just be given to you. They may be unclear sometimes. Rules may not be clear. They may change. Patterns don't just repeat. Feedback may be delayed. It may be inaccurate. Work next year won't look like work last year. So which one of these sounds like the situation we increasingly find ourselves in? Now, both, some of both for sure, but increasingly more of this one. More of this one. For example, over the last 60 years, the average lifespan of a company that's listed in the S&P 500 has dropped by about 70%. The rate of change is accelerating. And this has actually fundamentally changed our perception, our need to keep track of interconnecting and interdisciplinary parts and to think relationally about this changing world has fundamentally changed our perception at a very basic level. So that when you see this diagram, the central circle on the right probably looks larger to you because your brain is drawn to the relationship of the parts in the whole. Whereas someone who hasn't been immersed in modern work with its need for relational thinking and keeping track of interconnecting parts would see correctly, by the way, that the central circles are the same size. So here we are in this wicked work world. And in that kind of environment, sometimes our urge to specialize too early and narrowly can actually backfire really badly. In fact, in recent research in a dozen countries that matched people for their parents' years of education, their own years of education, and their national test scores, the difference was some people got career-focused training and some people got broader general education first. The pattern was those who got the focused training more likely to be hired right out of training, higher salary right away, but they end up so much less adaptable in this changing work world that when their industry is is changed. It's hard for them to find a place to fit, and they win in the short term and lose big in the long run because they're less adaptable. So here, I think, is when we perceive complexity in the world, this is the path that we sort of default to our intuition, right? And this is the one that we're told about, and it's the easiest to sell. But we're not in a world like this. We're in a world that's more like this. And so I think we need to think about developing ourselves this way if we want to be educated about who we are, our own match quality, and where we fit in the world. Because it can, if we do this in a world that's like this, it can backfire quite badly. In fact, consider a famous 20-year-long study of experts making predictions of geopolitical, economic, technological trends. The worst forecasters, so 20 years, over 80,000 predictions had to be made. The worst forecasters turned out to be the most specialized experts. Some of them actually got worse as they accumulated experience and credentials. These were people who spent their whole careers studying sort of one or two problems unique and came to see the whole world through kind of one lens or mental model, basically. And that doesn't mean these people weren't useful for generating knowledge, but it created certain kind of blind spots. I think a fun kind of offshoot or part of that area of research has to do with experts at 22 of the world's largest banks making predictions about currency exchange rates over a decade. So here you can see from year one to year two, the actual exchange rate goes up, and it's outside the entire range of all 22 forecasts from the banks. So then it goes up, it's outside the entire range again, and then it's outside the entire range again, and then it goes down, it's outside the entire range again. And then finally it's in the range, but then it's outside the range again. Then they get lucky once a decade, they won't get lucky again, outside the entire range, in the range by one. What this research found was that these specialist forecasts were essentially useless because they fell prey to certain cognitive biases because they had such a narrow view that they were always chasing the recent past, essentially. One of the sort of mildly entertaining but also scary findings was that there was an inverse relationship in the study between fame and accuracy. So the people you see making prognostications like on TV are often basically scientifically proven to be the worst forecasters in the world, which is seems funny until you think about the implications. But this isn't to say that there was nobody in this research who was good at seeing around the corner. There were people who did quite well. Sometimes they had areas of expertise, sometimes they didn't. But more important than what they thought was how they thought, how they chose to educate themselves about the questions they faced and the world around them. And the way they did that was as perspective collectors. They would go around to plenty of specialists. They needed specialists. They needed them. They would go to them for facts, not necessarily opinions, and approaches and angles and things they hadn't thought of. And they would collect those to educate themselves about all these perspectives and then synthesize those. As the researcher who led the work described these people, these so-called super forecasters, he said they have dragonfly eyes. Dragonfly's eyes are made of thousands of different lenses. Each one takes a different picture, and then those are synthesized in the dragonfly's brain. And that's how he likened the way that these people think. They diversify their streams of information. They build out their networks with people different from them, and they synthesize all these different facts and perspectives. So it's more how they think than what they think when they go about educating themselves about this complicated world around them. And they even use their social media often for diversifying their input so they don't just kind of fall prey to algorithms, right? Because when you go out in the world after college, you're going to become increasingly competent at something that you're doing out in the world, which is good. But what will come with that is that your streams of information will become increasingly narrow unless you push back against it. It will happen naturally unless you are forcibly diversifying your streams of information. Even in really highly accomplished and technical professions, this can happen. So think of one of those is medicine, right? Specialization has been both inevitable and beneficial in medicine. No doubt about it. It'd be crazy to say anything else. And yet, it has been a double-edged sword to the point where two recent Harvard-led studies found that if you are checked into a teaching hospital on the dates of a national cardiology convention with certain cardiac conditions, on the dates of a national cardiology convention, when the most esteemed specialists are away, you're less likely to die. And the researchers concluded that's because you're less likely to get an invasive procedure that some specialists have gotten used to doing over and over and over again, even in the face of contrary evidence that says it doesn't work in these certain scenarios. But they've gotten so used to doing it that they'll do it over and over and over and over again anyway. So it doesn't mean that we don't need those people, obviously, but that this, when they get this narrower and narrower experience, it can really be double-edged. I think we've seen some of that as well with the healthcare industry in the pandemic, which has done some incredibly amazing and heroic things, but also by its own admission, I think some rigidities have been exposed. So this is an editor's pick article in a journal of a professional association of hospital physicians, learning to unspecialize in the COVID-19 pandemic. And what it wrote about was how we had so many specialists who have just this tiny keyhole view of the whole healthcare delivery pipeline that when rapid change came, they were sidelined. Right? They couldn't fit in. We needed more. We had a surfeit of specialists and not enough generalists who understood sort of the more of the whole pipeline. And in fact, one of the recommendations here, and in fact, some healthcare organizations that I've been in touch with have done, is taken some of their specialists and basically embedded them back with teams of generalists, despecializing them in a sense. But really what it is once again, giving them a view of this holistic pipeline that they're part of, right? Is making them educated about the pipeline of which they are a part. Because when they become really, really specialized, and this happens in every industry, you cease to be educated about the breadth of the environment that you're involved in unless you proactively seek that out. And I think there is research to back up this idea of this re-embedding or de-specializing in every industry. This is a network map from research on networks of teams that creatively perform and do well in times of change. Okay. So these are maps of teams. And everywhere you see like colors, that's repeat collaborations between people in a team, like colors next to each other. What I want to draw your attention to is this in the middle, you see there's movement. There's movement of colors. There are people moving between teams. This is what the researchers who study this, by the way, this is a network map of an organization that does do well creatively and in times of change, that it has this movement between teams, or what the researchers did this called an import-export business of ideas. You have people taking knowledge that might be well understood on one team and cross-pollinating, moving it somewhere else where suddenly it's seen as something new. And this is going on constantly so that knowledge is moving throughout the network, helping more people get this broader perspective. It reminds me of of Bill Gore, the engineer who founded the company that created Gore-Tex. He modeled the company based on his observation that organizations did their most creative work in times of crisis, because the disciplinary boundaries fly out the window and people start learning what they can do for their colleagues, what their colleagues can do for them, right? If you see a network map that's mostly repeat collaborations, that's not an organization that will do well in a time of rapid change. Whereas Bill Gore liked to say, real work happens in the carpool, right? In these kind of informal settings where people can exchange information. And I think that's a special challenge for us to think about now, because where's the carpool right now? We don't have as much of the carpool. I think we have technological tools, though, that can allow us to systematically remake some of these opportunities. So maybe we don't have to rely on the carpool, on serendipity as much. But I do think we have to be more thoughtful about it. If we want to be educated about the systems of which we are a part, we have to diversify our information sources and run this import-export business of ideas, because it's not going to run itself. Now, why is that so effective? That import-export business of ideas. I want to give you one example of why. There are a lot of reasons, but one example, it's going to come in the form of a quiz, right? Because, you know, of course I'm going to give you a quiz, and yeah, you're definitely going to be graded on this, so do your best. Pretend you're a doctor and I'm your patient, and I have a malignant stomach tumor. Now, there's a ray, type of focused radiation that can destroy the tumor at sufficient intensity. The problem is at that intensity, it also destroys the healthy tissue that it passes through. So you can turn the rate down. Then it won't destroy healthy tissue, but it won't destroy the tumor either. So how can you save me? Okay, while you're thinking for a minute, I'm just gonna tell you a story, pass the time. There was once a country that was occupied by a brutal dictator, and a general wanted to liberate this country. And to do that, he had to capture a fortress in the center of the country. And there were roads radiating out like spokes from this fortress, and he had plenty enough troops. The problem was the roads all had strewn with landmines. And so if he marched his troops down any one road, he'd suffer a lot of casualties. So he had the idea to split up the troops in a single file line, synchronize their watches, and converge on the fortress at the same time. And they did that, and it worked, and they liberated the country. Okay, you saved me yet? I'll give you one more story while you're thinking. There was once a fire in a small town that was in danger of spreading to adjacent structures. But fortunately, it was near a lake. And so neighbors came with buckets and they were filling their buckets with water and throwing it on the fire, but it wasn't working. Then the fire chief showed up and she said, stop what you're doing. Everyone go down to the lake, fill your buckets, get in a circle. We'll arrange you in a circle around the fire. On the count of three, everybody throw. And they did that and dampened the fire and then they put it out. Fire chief gets a raise. Okay, have you saved me yet? And maybe it came to you that the solution is you can arrange multiple lower intensity rays around the point where you want them to converge and excise the tumor. Now, this is a very truncated version of a large body of research that shows that when you face a novel problem, the number of solutions you'll come up, possible solutions you'll come up with, and your likelihood of solving it has a lot to do, is strongly predicted by the number and breadth of analogies to structurally similar problems that you can come up with. And one of the predictors of that is the diversity of experiences of the people in the group who are trying to come up with them. So this is when you have this import-export business of ideas and you're diversifying each individual by moving them around and having them be both a recipient, an importer and exporter of ideas, you're diversifying the individuals, you're diversifying the teams, and you end up with these teams that are much more vibrant, much more equipped, much more educated about what they can possibly do in the face of novel challenges. Now I want to share with you some quotes from the work of a professor named Abby Griffin, actually at the University of Utah, and her colleagues, who studies serial innovators. Now, these are people who make repeated creative contributions to their organizations over and over, incredibly valuable. These are just descriptors that I pulled out of her and her colleagues' work of who these people are. And I hope they'll be a little bit less surprising to you than they would have been, you know, 23 minutes ago. So who are these people? They are systems thinkers. They have additional knowledge from peripheral domains. They repurpose things that are already available. They have an ability to connect disparate pieces of information in new ways. They synthesize information across different sources. They appear to flit among ideas. Doesn't normally sound like a compliment, I don't think. They have a broad range of interests. They read more and more widely than their peers. They have a need to learn significantly across domains, and they have a need to communicate with people with expertise outside of their own domain. Right. So, and Professor Griffin and her colleagues will sometimes seem like they're speaking in their work to HR professionals saying, just so you know, if you define your job too narrowly, you're going to select these people out because they are not the square peg, you know, for the square hole, so to speak. And in many cases in the work world, if you are inclined to be a serial innovator, you may have to move a lot to get this kind of breadth of experience because all of the momentum often just pushes you towards specializing more and more and more and more. And obviously, that is not the path to becoming one of these serial innovators. And so you have to take a path that is more difficult than the one that you will have plenty of opportunities to take a path of least resistance as you learn about yourself, your interests and abilities, as you learn about the organizations and systems you're a part of and the world that you're a part of. Right? That's why it's called the path of least resistance, because you'll have plenty of opportunities to take it, but it isn't the one that leads to this kind of innovative performance in so-called wicked learning environments, which is the work environment that the large majority or perhaps all of you are going into. I want to zoom out for a second and fast forward in your careers, because at some point, many of you will be involved in some way or another in setting up the systems that determine if your organizations and teams have a good import-export business of ideas going on that continues the education of people in those teams. You'll be involved in helping figure out how you can have that. And so I want to give an example that maybe will stick in your mind for down the road when you are part of creating these systems. And it comes from Wernher von Braun, engineer who led the development of the Saturn V rocket, the rocket that first put humans on the moon. Now, von Braun, the Saturn V rocket, 60 feet longer than the Statue of Liberty, pedestal included. So even if all the teams, engineering teams, were working on it at literally physically the same time, they weren't often in direct touch. And von Braun realized that the knowledge they were acquiring, everyone's knowledge affected everyone else in a big way. And so he needed to connect knowledge across the organization so that everyone could learn from each other. And so he came up with what he called Monday Morning Notes. Monday Morning Notes, every Monday morning, each of his engineering team leads had to put on one sheet of paper and one only their salient issues, problems, questions, concerns, whatever. Von Braun would get them all, put handwritten notes in the margin, and then recirculate them to everyone so everyone could see what he thought and what other people were thinking about. So here, for example, is one where he's saying, hey, look, your conclusion, it seems that way to me too, but go see this other person's notes and then let's talk. So he's inviting these multiple perspectives, like the people with dragonfly eyes, right? He's courting disagreement. Here he's saying, let's pin this down. We need to know if it calls for follow-up and further remedies. This was his way of putting a pin in something and saying, hey, everybody pay attention to this. Let's get everybody to weigh in. Maybe somebody knows something. And this was just part of their culture at all times. Look, this is, if you look at the date up here, it's 2 days after the first humans landed on the moon. Here he's saying, please see to it that they get that. He is actively connecting information across the organization. So he's working as the importer exporter. Somebody brought up some information that might be useful elsewhere. And so he's make sure that they get it. Here he is seen, you can see it says major anomaly. Someone identified a big problem and he congratulates them because he wanted to be seen publicly congratulating people who brought up problems before they got so big that you couldn't do anything about them or that they were a bigger problem. The only thing he didn't really like was if somebody wrote nothing of significance to report. If they had nothing to add to the group knowledge, he didn't really like that or believe that. This system was part of what some researchers call differentiating the chain of communication from the chain of command. One of the crucial things to do to create an organization that educates itself, a so-called learning organization, is differentiating the chain of communication from the chain of command. When Von Braun left, Monday Morning Notes stayed, but they turned into a form letter for only upward communication. And this was cited, so the chain of communication and chain of command became one and the same. And this was cited as one of the major cultural failings after the Challenger exploded. The chain of communication and the chain of command became the same. And so if you want a learning organization, you have to differentiate those and have that vibrant import-export business of ideas. I want to zoom much farther back in, back to the individual, to you. Because as you're going out into the work world, and no matter what stage you are in the work world, there are huge advantages accrue to people who know how they work. Peter Drucker, perhaps the most famous management guru ever, wrote a great essay I highly recommend everyone read called Managing Oneself, where he saw how the knowledge economy would develop. And that, as he put it, success would come to those who know themselves and how they work. I want to talk a little bit about a personal experience where I got to know myself and how I worked a little bit. This is me. I was in college when my lowered upper body weight ratio was well, better than it is now. I was a walk-on 800 meter runner, you know, half mile or walk-on, obviously meaning I wasn't good enough to get recruited. And this is my training partner, a guy named Scott, who was a blue chip recruit. You can see him here wearing his Canada national kit. He was 20 seconds faster than I was in the 800 meters when we were both juniors in high school. That's like, you'd go like this if you saw those people on the same track. It'd be embarrassing. And, you know, so I couldn't really keep up with him, obviously. I think they paired us together in this like old tradition of you put the walk on with the blue chip recruit. So the walk on just like goes away. But I stayed with it. And I had an advantage. I had a blessing in disguise, which was nobody needed me to perform in the short term. Didn't need me. And there was a young coach, that a volunteer coach, nobody really needed him either. So we kind of paired up in a sense. And for the next year and a half or 2 years, I could experiment with my training. At first I got worse. Didn't realize that was possible at the time, but that's what happened. And experimenting through that training, and I kept track of what worked and what didn't. This is part of what's called self-regulatory learning. So we always, you know, the phrase think and then act. Actually, a lot of psychology shows that you have to act and then think. You do stuff and then you reflect on it and figure out what worked and what didn't. And that's how you get to know your own strengths and weaknesses and skills. You have to actively reflect. So I had this period of about 2 years of experimentation where I could try things and see what worked and didn't and continue triangulating better training for me. So I had this, my blessing in disguise was this allowed period of experimentation because nobody needed me to go like this. So I was allowed to go like this. And when I hit on training that worked better for me, I started getting faster, like almost every race. And in about a minute and 52 seconds in the half mile, now I was getting pretty quick. I beat Scott for the first time. He never beat me again. I kept getting faster and he stagnated. And you know, our coaches and teammates say, oh, I'm the walk-on, like, you know, no talent, keep getting better, so tough. And I'm like, I don't know. I think I was doing less work than he was. It was just tailored to me what I had learned about myself. But I wasn't going to negate that flattering narrative, you know, because it led to all this cool stuff for me. Like, I got my university's award for the athlete who achieved significant athletic success in the face of unusual challenge and difficulty. My unusual challenge and difficulty just being that I stunk at first. I was so bad at first, I went to get examined by a pulmonologist and they found my results were consistent with the earliest stages of emphysema. I would assume most people that get those kinds of results find a different business to be in. This is about 2 years before I became a university record holder. Right? I had the blessing in disguise was that I had the chance to take a path, a more winding path. Now, I just want to leave you with one more thought. That process of self-regulatory learning, your need to diversify your information sources, to keep a broad view, because otherwise you will get narrow, momentum will make you that way, to create learning organizations that live and learn along with the individuals in them, is something you need to do for the rest of your life. We used to be in a world where you could have a discrete period of training and learning, you know, and followed by a discrete period of working. That world is gone. But there's something even more fundamental. It's called the end of history illusion. This is the psychological finding that at every point in life, people agree that they changed a lot based on their experiences and lessons and everything, and their how they like to spend their time, what they think they're good and bad at, what they're interested in, what kind of world they want to live in. At every point in time, we say, I changed a lot in the past, but now I'm pretty much done. And at every point in time, we are wrong. We underestimate future change in ourselves at every time point in life. Now, change does slow down. The fastest time of personality change is about 18 to your late 20s. So now for students, right, when you're probably thinking, I have to figure out what I want to be, right? That's basically like you're trying to pick for someone you don't even know yet for a world you can't conceive. So this process of learning about yourself, reflection on your actions has to go on your whole life. Maybe you've heard this if you've taken art history class, this beautiful legend about Michelangelo. This is a photograph of one of his statues I took a picture of, that he would see a fully formed figure in a block of marble and just chip away to free it. Or like drawing a figure out of a bath of water. He saw it fully formed and just chipped away. It's a beautiful image. Totally not true. In fact, 2/3 of everything Michelangelo touched ended up like this because he would have a different ideas as he went and reflect on what he was doing and what else he could do. And he would change directions and end up with not enough marble and he would abandon it. 2/3 of everything he touched, he abandoned. And that is much more reflective of how we actually are. We're works in progress claiming to be finished. We're actually this process of testing and learning, diversifying your experiences, diversifying your information sources is one that should follow you your whole life. If you want to continue to be an educated person in this world that will change around you. And so with that, I want to say thank you very much. It's an honor. And I would love to have some discussion and take some questions.